Human Resources Committee. And if anybody else has cell phones in the room, please turn them off. And I'm going to start by, because we don't have Democrats here, I have some tap-tap meetings scheduled, and I'm including on the list House Bill 2963 simply because we don't have amendments to it, and I do not desire to take any testimony on the bill as it currently is, and we are really short for time today. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2963, close the public hearing on House Bill 2963, open a public hearing on House Bill 2703, close the public hearing on House Bill 2703, open a public hearing on House Bill 3188, close the public hearing on House Bill 3188, open a public hearing on House Bill 3192, close public hearing on House Bill 3192, open a public hearing on House Bill 3261, close public hearing on House Bill 3261. And isn't here yet, is he? Okay, we're going to divert from the schedule because Representative Strobeck is not here yet, so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2528.
Janet. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2528 establishes and declares adult foster care provider rights, and it directs each adult foster home provider to post a notice of provider rights.
Okay, we will not be able to actually finish this bill today because there are significant amendments which we have in not in LC form, and so because there are two pages of amendments, they're not something I feel comfortable doing conceptually.
Why not, Mr. Chair?
Well, I like stretching the rules, but only to a point. Well, as soon as we get the sheet, we will... Actually, we can let Grover start out, I guess, so come on up. I already know you're on the list. And for the purposes of today, because we also have a subcommittee to get done today, and we have a special ceremony that starts at 4:30 today on the House floor, and so I'm going to ask everybody to cooperate with us and keep comments as brief as possible so we can get through the agenda. Go ahead, Grover.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons, and I represent the Association of Adult Care Providers of Oregon. As you know, those are owners and managers of adult foster homes that take up to 5 frail and elderly Oregonians into the home, and they provide care for those people on a 24-hour basis. There are about 1,950 of these homes throughout the state, and about 20% of them are members of the state association. From the early 1980s, when foster homes were first registered and then subsequently licensed, to the present time, caregivers have been saying that they need a provider bill of rights to define and protect their interests when it comes to relationships, not only with licensing agencies, but also with residents who choose to live in the foster homes. And House Bill 2528 is the product of all of those years of sorting out these relationships and putting them into writing. As you recall, Mr. Chair, there was a provider rights bill before this committee last session, and you passed it out with a do-pass recommendation. But after your vote and before the full House of Representatives had an opportunity to vote on it, SDSD developed a cost impact statement which was released by Legislative Fiscal, which said that it would cost $850,000 to protect the rights of providers. This bombshell hit only a few days before the end of the session, and there was insufficient time to develop counter information. So we're back again with nearly the identical bill, asking you to again consider these 14 enumerated rights. But most importantly, the bill This bill says there is no new cause of action created. Therefore, there is no cost impact, and SDSD has signed on to the jointly negotiated bill. And Mrs. Cindy Hannum is here and will testify to that effect. And she will also indicate that the materials that we handed to you is appropriate copy of the jointly agreed upon language, which really I guess we'd call hand and gross. But that's where we are. The substance of the bill does the following things very quickly. It says that providers, caregivers will be shown respect by government regulators, that they can terminate a contract under certain circumstances within the existing rules, that they do not have to perform services that are over and beyond what they have agreed to do and what is allowed by SDSD, that they are entitled to know about the health condition of a resident or a potential resident, that they can refuse to enter into a contract under certain circumstances, and that they can ask for identification from certain people who are coming to the house and be told the purpose of the visit, and that any investigation of the home will be done lawfully and within administrative rules, that an attorney can go with a provider who is being questioned, and that they can see a report which evaluates the provider, and that their personal living quarters are private and not subject to inspection except for specified reasons as specified in the full bill, and that a complaint can be filed by the provider with the agency, with SDSD, and yet SDSD does not have is not required to investigate any other agency, and that government agents cannot instill fear or threaten a provider who has testified before a legislative committee and provided information to a state agency, and lastly, that providers are entitled to exercise their constitutional right of due process of law. Providers understand that this is not a perfect bill, but the association believes it's better than no bill at all. It is a step in the right direction because it defines and clarifies the rights and duties of a lot of people involved with long-term caregiving in the adult foster home movement. And we respectfully urge the committee to pass House Bill 2528. Thank you very much.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of struck by... I've been gone for a long time, so I'm kind of struck by the need to have a Bill of Rights that talks about respect. And would kind of like to know what has occurred that we would have to have a Bill of Rights and where you have to set forth the information for complaints and all those other kinds of issues that we used to just do on a normal basis. Can you help me?
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Chair and Representative Winters, thank you for that question. It is surprising that an industry, statewide industry, this magnitude would have to spell out the need for a documentation of relationships. This is the result of relationships between foster home providers and inspectors and licensors and others who, ombudsman people who are coming to the home, who have not shown providers consideration and respect and have exercised their authority in a in sometimes overbearing way. I've cleaned that up, and we used to fill the room with people who would come and talk about specific cases. So the language saying that we wish to be treated with consideration and respect has a lot of substance underneath it, and it is sad, Representative Winters, that we would have to ask for that.
I also cannot understand why it would cost an additional $800,000, whatever the impact statement was, to do what the person should be doing in the first place.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winters, I use the term bombshell. That really did surprise us last time. But The way that was dealt with this time around is that we expressly agreed with SDSD, who sent this to the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office came back and said and wrote in there, there will be no new cause of action created by this bill. And that means that it takes a lot of the punch out of it, but we had to agree to that to get them to sign on to the bill, and we are jointly in agreement. So that's why I said it's better than no bill at all. And it doesn't have an $850,000 cost impact or any cost impact this time around.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
David Niebel. First, have you seen the amendment?
Yes, okay. Mr. Chair, I have. Thank you. My name is David Niebel. I work with the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of United Seniors of Oregon, the Oregon State Council of Senior Citizens, and the Citizens Coalition for Quality Long-Term Care in opposition to House Bill 2528. I also received a call this morning from Meredith Cote, the long-term care ombudsman for Oregon, who indicated that she could not be here, but she wanted me to pass along that if she were here, she would have been testifying in opposition to this bill also. I think that this bill is unnecessary because many of the things that are in it are already in the law for long-term care or for adult foster care facilities. I also think that the bill won't make much difference if it's passed because there's no remedy for a long-term care, or I'm sorry, an adult foster home that feels that its rights have been violated. I don't think anyone questions the need to have close scrutiny of this industry, which houses very many vulnerable people in the homes of the people who provide the service. And this unquestionably leads to friction between the people who are regulated and the people who regulate them. And I think that in this peculiar situation where the service is provided actually in the provider's home, that tends to be, that friction tends to be highlighted. I'm not questioning the need for the regulators to treat the providers in a fair and equitable manner and to accord them respect when they are doing inspections and regulatory activities. But the issue is whether there's any particular need for this industry to have this added protection or to put this into the statute. And I simply do not see that this is a crying need for this particular industry. If the agency was alleged to have violated provisions of this bill, for example, if they were alleged not to treat the provider in a fair and equitable manner, I'm not sure what that means. I'm not sure what the provider would be able to do about that. And the agency or the administrative law judge or wherever this would go would be dealing with these very amorphous issues. I think that the important thing to remember is that the focus of public policy should be on the relationship between the providers of services and the residents of these facilities, and not on the relationship between the providers and the regulators. So that's why I'm testifying against this bill, and the organizations that I'm speaking on behalf of are also against this bill. Questions?
I do have a question. David, you said that the relationship should be between the provider and the patient, and I do agree that that is a relationship that is there. But since this is a contracted relationship with the provider and the state, there's also another relationship. So it's not a singular piece, and I guess my concern is that there's something going on here, or we wouldn't have all these people here talking about this issue, and whether it belongs in a bill, but it means that we have a situation where things are kind of out of kilter, if you will, and somehow there needs to be, there's a lot of people in this room that's talking about this issue. And I don't know what the remedy is, but it causes me some concern to say that just one piece is taken care of and not the whole piece is taken care of.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, I think that, first of all, let me say that I think that the service that these folks provide is essential for provision of long-term care in Oregon. So there's no question about that. I think that in some cases, in many of these cases, there are two sides to all of these stories. I mean, I think that some providers feel that they've been wronged or treated brusquely or treated unfairly. I think that the other side of those stories may often turn out to show that, indeed, there was a problem that was worthy of investigation and that the investigation might have been thwarted by the provider. So I think that just looking at it from one side is a mistake. I think that there are remedies, and I think perhaps the folks at SDSC could speak to this better than I could, but I think if a provider feels that he or she is mistreated, they can go up the chain of command at SDSC to attempt to get satisfaction for that. That's what I've been a legal services attorney for a long period of time, and that's what we have advised our clients to do when they run into welfare workers, for example, who are not treating their clients well or with respect or are denying their rights. We advise them to ask for that person's supervisor, and that remedy, that informal chain of command, I think is the ultimate check on overzealous regulators. So I think, and I'm not sure that the adult foster care industry has truly used that avenue of complaint. I think that there also, I mean, there are stories, for example, of adult foster homes complaining that regulators have gone into their private space and gone rifling through their personal belongings. Clearly, that's appropriate. Inappropriate. Excuse me. Clearly, that's something for which SDSC would respond to a complaint if that were going on. I don't think anybody disagrees with that, but I just simply don't see that this adds anything to the law that's not there now. And I think if we put this in the statute, there are going to be other folks coming in subsequent sessions asking for their own provider bill or for their own bill of rights.
I just wanted to get a sense of what's driving the issue.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Joanne Sproud.
I'm late in the session. Chairman, committee members. I'm Joanne Cody Sproul from Albany, Oregon. I've been a care provider for nearly 13 years. I'm currently the Albany chapter president for ACPO. I wanted to go on record in support of HB 2528 for one very important reason. I believe this bill will give the Oregon providers a sense that we are indeed an entity. And therefore, we will have perhaps a greater motivation to be involved and proactive in not only the issues facing our industry, but especially in raising the standards of our industry. And I would like to ask you to please recommend House Bill 2528.
Questions? Thank you very much. May Dash?
Chairperson Cruz and members of the committee, my name is May Dash. I speak for the Oregon chapters of the Alzheimer's Association. We are a public policy coalition of the Oregon chapters of the National Association, and we advocate for persons afflicted with Alzheimer's disease and related disorders. We adamantly oppose House Bill 2528, the creation of an adult foster care provider's bill of rights that we believe are already covered by Oregon and federal law. We are especially troubled by subsections 2, 3, 4, 5, and 13 under Section 2. Each of those subsections directly challenges, even threatens, facility residents and their families. More than 60% of the residents in adult foster care homes suffer from dementia, primarily of the Alzheimer's type. This population constitutes some of the most vulnerable individuals in our society. The adult foster care industry apparently views their proposed Bill of Rights as a counterpart to residents' rights. Hardly a legitimate comparison, since the purpose of residents' rights is to empower the extremely fragile long-term care population. Providers have rights, as does everyone else within the long-term care system, but they do not have the vulnerability that justifies the approach taken in the residents' Bill of Rights. Many residents in long-term care settings, as well as their concerned families, feel as though they are held hostage. Family members attending our Alzheimer's support group often state that they are afraid to voice complaints to facility personnel, even when their complaints are justified, for fear of retaliation or eviction, an especially ominous prospect if the person is a Medicaid client or a difficult Alzheimer's patient. Oregon's adult foster care home system was developed to provide a home-like friendly environment for frail or elderly persons in need of some assistance. A provider bill of rights posted in each facility, perhaps given to each client at the time of admission, is the antithesis of that concept. It has no place in a home-like setting. It should not become a part of Oregon law. The Oregon chapters urge you to vote against House Bill 2528. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony, Ms. Dash. But I do have a question, and that's, you know, I don't know currently what kind of information the home is foster care homes are allowed to have pertinent to the patient's medical information. But wouldn't you agree that if they agree to take a patient that has dementia or that has Alzheimer's, that they're also taking the responsibility to take care of that person? And so really, I think the way I read this, really all they're asking for is that they be given the updated information so that they can perform that responsibility.
Right, and I think they do receive that information. I think that my feeling is that they do have an idea of what the problems are when they receive a patient, a resident, certainly. They need to know, if they're dealing with dementia, they need to know that the person that they're taking in is suffering from dementia, certainly.
Thank you.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to get a reason for the opposition, because you talked, and certainly we all agree that the fragile individual often is the vulnerable. But I kind of, in looking at this Bill of Rights that I'm seeing, that they're saying there's another vulnerability. It doesn't have anything to do with the patient, but it has to do with the relationship with the state or the inspectors. And you're saying that we shouldn't do anything about that linkage. Is that what your testimony is? Am I correct?
Mine is strictly from the family residence point of view. I think there's kind of different parts to this Bill of Rights. They're ones dealing with agencies, with senior services and the long-term care ombudsman program. They're pretty much identified here. And then there are ones dealing with the residents and their families. I think they're sort of separate issues. I think we would like to have all the subsections dealing with residents removed, residents and their families. But I do think they are kind of two different problems, certainly.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
I forgot to do this. Turn this in when I came.
Never too late.
Sorry about that.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one more real short question?
Representative Crummell.
Thank you. Did I, well, I asked you two questions, but they're both short.
I would have been disappointed if it had only been one.
Did I hear you correctly that you are opposed to subsections 2, 3, 4, and 5 of the...
I think it was. I didn't keep a copy.
I think it was 2, 3, 4, 5, and 13.
And they are the ones that deal with residents and their families, right?
Okay. But I also want to clarify something, and that is... You wouldn't want a home to operate outside of its scope, though. Subsection 3 says to decline to perform services for the resident or the family of the resident that are beyond the scope of services specified by a division rule or by a contract that conforms to division rules between the resident and the provider.
My understanding is that that is covered by current law. But this just reiterates current law. But certainly, our Alzheimer's Association, we are very concerned when people who do not have perhaps the background to deal with persons suffering dementia are caring for persons with dementia. That is a great concern to us.
Yes.
Because that's when there's abuse, when
yes.
they really don't know how to handle a person who's got some severe problems.
So, again, just to kind of clarify, you wouldn't want a home operating outside of its scope.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Definitely.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that I understood
yes.
correctly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lee Hazelwood. Just for your information, it's still too early for apples.
Mine will be very short. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've been trying to run between the Department of Human Resources budget here, and I just picked up on this. Mr. Chair, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I'm legislative coordinator of the Governor's Commission. The Governor's Commission on Senior Services just heard this committee did not receive copies of the proposed amendments, and I have picked them up now, I think, and so. But the commission cannot support the original version of this bill for the following reasons. Provider Bill of Rights could be used to intimidate clients and their families from reporting real concerns. And that's always been a main issue with me because in my previous life I was in business, and so I think it's very crucial that somebody were able to do this. And I feel it could be used to limit SDSD's access to all foster home provider homes.
Lee, you haven't seen the amendments in
time. I just picked them up and haven't had a chance to read them, but quickly, I do see some things in here that I still don't like. I was on the original group who met with the foster home people, but I didn't meet at the last meeting because I wasn't invited because some of the things that I wanted in here I didn't get, but it's okay. So the Governor's Commission is opposing this bill. I do feel, though, Mr. Chair, that with a bill that Representative Winters has, an ombudsman bill could correct a lot of this, and so I do want to congratulate her on that bill because I have said through that testimony I think that would correct some of these problems that we keep hearing. I'm not plugging your bill per se, Representative Winters, but I have followed it and I like what I see in the bill. So if you want me to testify it for, I will. But frankly, I'm concerned about if I have Aunt Sue, Uncle Jim or somebody like that, and I want to know ahead of time if they decide they want to go to a foster home. I want to know if there have been complaints in the foster home. Do I have that? Now, this bill, I think, says that it will be posted at the foster home. I would want to know that if I make it a call, and maybe I haven't read it right, but the original one I had to be posted at the home, so... The Governor's Commission is opposing this bill, though. And I might point out we have opposed similar bills to this before.
Questions? Lee, when you've had a chance to look over the amendments, would you get back
to I'll try to read them between
concerns?
And get back to you.
Okay. Any other questions?
I welcome your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you for hearing from Mr.
Mr. Chair, may I ask him just a real quick, short question?
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have no vote on the prison at Wilsonville. Sorry.
No, I would prefer not to talk about any prisons at Wilsonville right now. Is there, Lee, in your knowledge base, is there a shortage of homes in Oregon?
Foster homes?
Yes.
Foster homes?
No,
I don't think there's a shortage of foster homes in Oregon. They are a crucial part of the Oregon long-term care system.
Yes.
But I think because of assisted living facilities and residential care facilities, some foster homes are closing. Because fortunately or unfortunately, however you look at it, that Oregon does give people a choice of where they want to go. So there is not a shortage to my knowledge. I live in state in Oregon, and we do have two of these in state in Oregon. They're very nice places. I visit people who are there. They're very nice places.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Brandt.
David Brandt.
Chairman Cruz, members of the committee, I'm here in support of HB 2528 directly because of the way I have been treated by senior and disabled services. These people do not treat us well. They do not treat us with respect. And if you have a complaint, it's like dropping a penny into a giant well. It is never resolved, responded to, or solved. And I have been there several times. This bill is in direct response to the way we have been treated. We wouldn't need our own Bill of Rights if we were treated with respect, if we were called before they came out. You know, I run an adult foster care home, and I'm very busy. I'm working with my clients on a regular basis, and to have somebody from senior services come knock on my door unannounced, demand to see my records, treat me like I am a criminal, find me if they find some of my paperwork not in an exact correct order, post or state that they have had a complaint, but never tell me what the complaint is, never put it in writing because it's confidential. There's just a complaint out there so they can rifle through my personal residence, is not being treated with respect. And as far as some of these other issues, we love the people we take care of. We work very hard to take as good of care of them as we possibly can. And you're right, there are a lot of adult foster care homes or other things in the state. If we did a poor job, the family would have those people out of our home like that. If they thought there was abuse or mistreatment, they would be gone. We don't have a problem with the way we treat our people and the way we deal with the families. We have a problem with the way we are being treated by senior services. Do you have a question, Representative?
Representative Winters.
You said you've complained to senior services. Have you gone beyond senior services? Have you complained to the governor's office?
No, I have asked for a complaint procedure, and I have, you know, it's like, well, you can call somebody in Salem, but that's kind of where it ends. And I've talked to several people here in Salem and the head of senior services, and they've listened. They've done a lot of we'll see what we can do. And I've never had a written response. I've never heard back from them. I have never seen a change in the behavior of the local representative towards me and my care home.
But you haven't contacted the citizens representative in the governor's office?
No. I was not even aware that there was one. When asked who I could contact, what I could do, this is like the fox watching the chicken coop. You know, you complain about to them about the way they're running their own operation, and they don't want to hear it.
What about your relationship with the long-term care ombudsman?
I haven't ever had them come out. They've never come to my facility.
Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand what you're saying, that SDSD is a bully of an organization that ignores rights and runs roughshod over your home.
They appear to be extremely unorganized at times. It's very difficult to get a pat answer out of them.
I guess the question I've got is, looking at the bill and I guess the amendments here, what part of this is going to give you any protection? Because it says specifically there will be no remedy or cause of action.
Exactly.
So you're going to have the same,
been watered down.
So the same thing, you're going to have the same complaints. You're going to go in with, you're going to show them this piece of paper that gives your supposed Bill of Rights, and they're going to know with this that there's nothing else they have to do anyway.
Exactly.
So what is this bill going to do to protect you?
This bill has been watered down. What I would like to see is a bill that would have them notify us if they're going to come out. And their response is, well, if you're doing something illegal or wrong, we can't catch you if we tell you we're coming. That puts us as a criminal already. We're not saying we don't want them to come. We're just saying if you come, treat us with respect. You know, it's like you're on committee here. How would you like somebody to march in and say, I want to see all your records up there in files? And you say, well, we're in committee here. You say, well, it doesn't matter. We have the authority to do that unannounced. And we're not asking for the sun, moon, and the stars. We're asking to be treated with respect. And that's the only terminology we could come up with. Yeah, it's not adequate in my mind, but it's a start. It's a place to go from. And Representative Krummel? When you ask the question outside the scope, now this is just my interpretation of this, when we're dealing with a family, okay, if they have somebody there, say, and we're taking care of them, and they say, well, I would like grandma's hair permed twice a week, okay, not really in the scope of their medical treatment, okay, outside of our contract, but and we have the right to say, well, you know, perm solution costs $40, and I don't really know how to give perms. I would rather she go to a beauty salon or have a beautician come in and do this. We're not talking about the direct care that we have been hired to do. Okay? We're not talking about medical treatment, as this is my belief. But we're talking about these small things that may be requests that are outside of our contract that don't deal with the medical treatment or help of these people. All we're saying is we have the right to say no, that we're not comfortable with doing that. We're not saying we're not going to take care of these people, and we're not going to say we're going to work outside of our space. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Any
questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm going to, that's, please, we need to practice decorum, especially on that side of the dais, because we don't always do it here. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2528, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2495. Representative Strobeck, thank you for waiting, sir.
Chairman Cruz, members of the committee, thank you for delaying the opening of the public hearing on this bill. I did have some other business to take care of, so I appreciate you waiting for me. I wanted to just briefly summarize House Bill 2495 for you, and since it does have a subsequent referral to revenue, ask that you take action to go ahead and refer the bill. I am not normally in favor of tax credits. In fact, we've spent a great deal of time in the Revenue Committee the last few weeks getting rid of some tax credits, and I must tell you it's a very painful and difficult process to do. However, in the course of that, I've also discovered that there are some purposes for which tax credits are appropriate, and I believe this is one. I was approached by Dolores Raymond to introduce this family caregiver tax credit bill, and I believe that that the home caregivers in the state provide an invaluable service, and I'm in favor of supporting them. This tax credit offers a $1,500 credit for family caregivers with no restriction on age or the condition that requires the caregiver. It would provide support in a situation where a well spouse or family member is providing care for an ill spouse or a child with a developmental disability. There's a household income cap, $60,000. Family caregiver cannot be reimbursed, must provide assistance with two or more activities of daily living. And take this moderate approach one step further, Mrs. Raymond, who is a member of the Washington County Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, took the bill to them for a critique, and they suggested two amendments, which you have in the dash ones. And that would be that the caregiver must provide care on a daily basis, and only one tax credit is allowed per family. And, the bill is in keeping with our philosophy of keeping people in their own homes whenever possible. Over the past decade, we have shifted the focus of long-term care for the elderly away from nursing homes towards keeping them in the least restrictive possible environment and in their own homes whenever possible. This philosophy has saved the taxpayers millions of dollars, and as we have seen the closure of institutions such as Fairview, we see a greater need for supporting those people who do care for family members in their own homes. The amount of financial support included in House Bill 2495 would enable family caregivers to pay for some respite care, which is a very serious need. In fact, I encountered that personally as I was campaigning and going door to door and met a couple of folks in my district who are caring for disabled people in their homes, and they have virtually no opportunity to ever get away. They're pretty much 24-hour caregivers. So the continuation of in-home care by family caregivers would somewhat lessen their dependence on paid caregivers, as well as avoiding costs of institutional care. And so I ask you to please take positive action on this bill and approve it and send it on down to the Revenue Committee.
Representative Strobeck, you referenced the dash one that we don't have.
Oh, is that right? Okay. The dash one amendments, I do have a copy I can give to your staff, specifies that the care is delivered daily, and that only one taxpayer would be eligible. The original bill allowed people filing separately to both qualify for the credit, but this would only say one per household.
Could we assume, Representative Strobeck, that the chair of the Revenue Committee would be willing to add that amendment down there so we could pass it up?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you have it in LC form?
We do have it in LC form.
Okay, we could get copies and we could do that here.
I'm sorry, I apologize that you didn't have a copy of that in advance. It was one that we did work up after the printed bill. But, yeah, your choice, Mr. Chair, as to whether you want to send it as amended or pass it along. We do have copies of the dash one available.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Representative. This is a good bill.
Thank you very much.
And we have quite a bit of testimony. First off, let me say it is my intention to do exactly what the good representative suggested and send this bill to Revenue today so that he can have it to deal with next week. So I do think this is a very good bill, and I applaud you for bringing this for us. And we do have quite a few folks that are signed up, and you're more than welcome to testify. You may also want to come back when they do this in Revenue also. So I guess you could consider this a warm-up for the real show, because that's where the decision will be made as to whether to include this tax credit. So first off, we have Dolores Raymond and Sally Madden. And Leanne Royal. Welcome.
Chairman Cruz and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Dolores Raymond. I requested this bill based on my experience as a caregiver. I have not been a family caregiver, but I owned and operated an adult foster home for 6 years. So I'm very familiar with the responsibilities of a caregiver and the wear and tear on the person. One of the things that really impacted me as a caregiver was the change in the relationship with my family. I have four adult children and I think eight grandchildren. I lose count sometimes. But my relationship with my family changed dramatically during those 6 years. And at the end of the 6 years, when I had a bad case of burnout and made a very difficult decision to sell my home, my children were delighted because they got their mother back and I had time to spend with my grandchildren again. And I can certainly sympathize with the adult foster care providers who are here in the audience. When I sold my adult foster home, I then took a position as senior services coordinator at Tualatin Hospital in Hillsboro. And I, as part of that, facilitated an Alzheimer's support group. And that difference, the difference between a professional paid caregiver and a family caregiver, made a dramatic impact on me because I saw how much more difficult the tasks are for a family caregiver who has a very deep emotional involvement with their relative. The people in my home became my second family, but I was able to attain just that slight degree of objectivity that enabled me to hang in there and provide care for 6 years. A family caregiver does not have that objectivity. They're also lonely, socially isolated. They can become physically exhausted in the process of providing care. The Alzheimer's Association recently concluded a new study of caregivers and concluded that family caregivers provide care at an immense cost to their emotional, financial, and physical well-being. And that sometimes results in the death of a caregiver, and then the person who was receiving care must be institutionalized. I remember with great fondness a woman who came to my support group. She was the primary caregiver for her husband, who had Alzheimer's disease, and also cared for her mother, who was over 90. My friend died. Her husband was placed in an adult foster home, where he went downhill rapidly, and he died less than a year later. Her mother recently celebrated her 100th birthday, and I suspect that had my friend had access to respite care and been able to take better care of herself, maybe all three of those family members might have been there for that 100th birthday celebration. I included in my written testimony some dollar figures, and I'm not going to read those. You can read that for yourselves, but it is very, very expensive. The budget for Oregon Project Independence is $12,194,288 for the 97-99 biennium. Looking at Washington County, where I live, there are nearly 38,000 people over the age of 65. 16% of those people need assistance with activities of daily living. By the time we get to age 85 and over, this increases to nearly 50%. That's a lot of people who are needing care, and it can be very expensive. Of all those people in Washington County, right now, there are approximately 70 people who are eligible for in-home assistance, but they are not receiving services due to the shortage of paid caregivers and inadequate funding. So with all these people who are growing older and needing care, what are we going to do? One of the things the legislature did in the last session was to enact the Lifespan Respite Program, House Bill 2013. Working with this program, a family caregiver could locate a qualified respite caregiver and use the $1,500 tax credit under House Bill 2495 to pay for that respite care. And it would make a tremendous difference in the life of the caregiver and of the person who's receiving care. Kind of stop and take a look at your schedules here, and I know that you're all busy and you have very hectic schedules, but I think that you get home on a weekend and can take a break once in a while, so think about what it would be like if you were subject to the kind of pressure that you're subject to here in the legislature every day of the week, year-round, without ever getting a break, and that's what family caregivers do every day. In this country, there is a growing awareness of the value of family caregivers and the large amount of money that they're saving our long-term care system. President Clinton mentioned this in his State of the Union address. There are, at this time, 17 states in this country that are currently working on caregiver support legislation. I don't know what this bill would cost us in tax revenue. In the 97 session, it was estimated at $6.1 million. But I ask you to look at $6.1 million and compare it to what the cost is for institutional care. $24,000 to $36,000 per person per year. That's a big difference. I think that a tax credit for family caregivers would be an investment in this state's long-term care system that is outstanding. We have national and international recognition for our long-term care system, and family caregivers are the first link in that chain of long-term care, and they are way overdue in recognition and some support. So I ask you to vote favorably on this bill. I didn't see Diane over here when I came up, so I'm going to give her my written testimony. I also have the testimony from Leanne Riles, who is the program coordinator for the Lifespan Respite Program in Marion County, who had to leave to go to another function. Today is Respite Awareness Day, so I thought the timing of this hearing today was great. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions? Ms. Raymond?
My name is Sally Madden. I'm a family caregiver. My husband had what's called early onset Alzheimer's, and that's when they get it at a younger age. He died recently, just a few months ago, of his Alzheimer's symptoms. And I'm supposed to give you some idea of what it's like to be a family caregiver. First of all, it's a long-term situation where you're dealing with cognitive dilemmas. It's emotionally, it's physically, it's spiritually, and it's financially devastating. It's a nightmare of paperwork from day one until after their death. It often takes away your health. And for me, the extra paperwork hasn't stopped yet, and I'm still working on my health. So much of their care is custodial and physical because of the physical changes they have and the cognitive decline, so the needs are not covered by any kind of health insurance. It's more than just everyday job, 5 to 7 days a week. It's all night also, because they don't sleep well at night. As much as I did every bit of this with love, it just gets too hard to do it all alone. When they need constant physical assistance for sitting down and sitting up and going to the bathroom and dressing and turning on a faucet. And then there's the mental monitoring. You have to remember where they've been so you can check if they close the car door so you don't have a dead battery when you have to take them to the doctor. And you've got to just keep your mind on them all the time. It's a 24-hour day monitoring. And how do you get anything else done? Like bills paid, car fixed, or errands done. And you can't always take them with you, because if you take them with you, you're spending all your time finding them a bathroom, helping them on and off the toilet, dealing with their anxiety from being away from home, dealing with their fear of traffic, their lack of cognitive reasoning, their physical weakness, and on and on. You compare this maybe to taking care of a toddler with adult habits and adult needs. You can't rest at night because they wake up confused and don't know what time it is. Or you may have an accident where they have incontinency. With my husband, he also had sleep apnea on war machine, and this was caused by his Alzheimer's. So I had to get up and check his machine several times a night to make sure he hadn't taken it off. Or I may have to see that he's covered because he could not cover himself anymore. And what do I do? What do I do if I'm sick or really need a break? And remember, it's better for both of us to be able to stay at home where he has familiarity in his surroundings and familiar routine that raises his quality of life, let alone saving taxpayers' money and, on the long run, saving the national debt that can be caused in the future by Medicaid. An example of our life would be when a windstorm occurs and we have an electrical outage. It's an inconvenience to all of us. But what happens with an Alzheimer's patient is trauma. With their anxiety, flashlights are monsters. Give them mass confusion and fear. And what he could usually do that day, he won't be able to do that night because of the anxiety. I had to sit him in a recliner chair because he's not allowed to lay down with sleep apnea during the storm. So I slept in a chair next to him, or dozed. And it was difficult to get him out of the chair because he was so confused, and he was a heavy man. And when they have anxiety, they can't take directions. You can't tell them how to do it. He wouldn't let me go outside to get wood for our wood fireplace for fear he'd be left alone or that a tree would fall on me. After two nights, I finally was too exhausted, and so was he, so I moved out of the home and took him to a motel that had electricity, so where we spent the rest of the time of the storm. That makes it expensive also. I figured out that if this $1,500 tax credit had been in existence while Dan was still living, I could have gotten 150 hours per year of in-home respite companionship so I could get things done or take a break, or 82 hours per year of a professional aide, that's for a higher level of care when they need diapers changed, or 75 afternoons outside the home in a day respite program for their own good and mine, and 37 and a half days per year of care in a daycare facility. All this keeps him home longer, which all fits into that succession of happenings that actually saves us money. And I really appreciate you giving me this time.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Michael Bailey, Judy Christensen, and Kim Feeney.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Bailey. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm a commissioner of the Oregon Disabilities Commission and the parent of a daughter with a developmental disability. In my professional life, I am a community organizer for the Community Partnerships Project of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council and work with about 11,000 families of people with developmental disabilities around our state. Mr. Chairman, the point I hope to make here to you about why this is of particular significance to families with developmental disabilities is that our children enjoy, as you know, the right to a free and appropriate public education under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. That is a mandated right that they enjoy. It expires at age 21, and after that there are no mandated services. And in Oregon, basically, our children at age 21 become the responsibility of their parents, in a moral sense at least, if not a legal sense. My daughter is 11, and I recognize my responsibilities to her. I wholly enjoy performing them, and I'm enjoying her very much. I may feel differently when I'm 80 and she's 50. What we really need in Oregon, Mr. Chairman, is significant action on the 3,800-person wait list for adults with developmental disabilities in our state. Frankly, for reasons that are understood to the chair and other members of the committee, I don't think that's very likely to happen in this near future. However, a $1,500 tax credit will go a long ways to toward eliminating that fiscal time bomb that has to do with families disintegrating under the pressure of caring for mentally retarded, frequently non-ambulatory, incontinent children 24 days a week. I've addressed some of the specific needs that we could expect a $1,500 tax credit to help us with in my written testimony. I appreciate your earlier comments. I am now through. I'm happy, of course, to answer any questions any members of the committee may have.
My name is Judy Christensen, and I'm a single grandparent raising my granddaughter, Priscilla. Priscilla has cerebral palsy, and if I could, I'll just read my testimony, and then I can keep track of what I'm saying. I took legal custody of Priscilla when she was 2 years old. Her parents were unable and unwilling to care for her at the time due to alcohol and drug abuse. And by the way, you're going to have a lot of children with disabilities coming from drug-affected babies and so forth. Priscilla has cerebral palsy. She was born premature and suffered a brain hemorrhage as a result of the birth. I had a choice to turn her over to the state custody or raise her myself. In my mind, there was no question as to what to do, even though at the time no one knew the extent of her disabilities. Although Priscilla and I are currently working hard to teach her independent living skills, she still requires assistance with bathing, grooming, helping with toileting, physical exercise, stressing, etc. And by the way, I have her full permission to talk about her, and I'm glad that you allow her to come with me. She also has ongoing medical complications produced by her condition. It's the latest, and there have been 3 and 7 years, with a surgical procedure she received last December 17th, where they rebuilt her hip socket and reshaped her leg bone. The results, it resulted in a very painful major procedure, which took a total of 6 days in the hospital and 8 weeks in a full body cast at home. She experienced major pain, and it set her physical gains to be independent back 2 years. She later suffered major depression and anxiety problems. The major portion of my time when not at work, because I am fully employed full-time, is spent caring for Priscilla and providing for her needs. For example, she had a total of 15 appointments to keep in this month of April. I transport her and stay with her during these appointments. They include one IEP meeting at school for special ed, one dental appointment, one medical appointment, 2 psychological counseling sessions, 9 physical therapy sessions, 1 appointment to fit her with new AFOs, which is her leg braces. They also spend an enormous amount of time completing paperwork and forms necessary for her care and equipment. The latest was over 10 hours filling out forms and getting documentation for Social Security to prove she is still disabled. Interesting, because there is no cure for CP. Now I have to do it again for Voc Rehab in the state of Oregon, since Social Security turned determination over to them, and the different federal and state agencies have different forms and different documentation needs. These are not exaggerated facts. I can back them. When I return home from work and or various appointments at night, my time is spent doing regular parent activities like dinner and homework. However, I also need to pay special attention to Priscilla's homework because she has learning difficulties, and the work she missed while out of school for surgery set her way behind. I also do physical therapy with her and bathe her and get her ready for bed. In the morning, I get up an hour early to get her up, fed, dressed, and groomed for school. Because I am self-supporting and need to work, I spend an average of $200 per week for child care. More in the summer, less in the winter, and as she gets older, it's going to be harder and harder to pay for that. I seldom leave her on weekends for respite care because I can't afford it, and finding someone is difficult at times because of her special disabilities unless you hire a special person to do that. The reason I continue to provide care is because Priscilla is one of the best things that have ever happened to me. She gives me back much more than she takes. She is my friend and my family, and even with all the things we do together, she is well worth it. By my taking Priscilla to raise as my own, I have saved the state of Oregon hundreds of thousands of dollars. I know many grandparents that do the same thing for disabled kids. The family caregivers in Oregon have done an immense favor for taxpayers by using their own resources and efforts to provide care for loved ones. If all the disabled Oregonian citizens who are now out there being taken care of by family were to turn over to the state the care of these individuals, the result would be a major expense and problems with state systems. The state of Oregon has stated many times that they support families and communities that take care of their own. We have
And all we are now asking is that you show your support in passing this bill. This is your opportunity to make a statement about family values and to support those families that have already given up much of their own lives to take care of others.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Are there any questions? I want to thank you and Priscilla for coming and appreciated your comments very much. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Do we have Kim Finney? Out of the room? Oh, she had to leave. Okay, so then we have Nicola Cribb and Nancy Talbot. If there one of you would start.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Nicola Cribb. I'm representing today the Oregon chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. And I'll keep my comments brief, and I think most of the points I want to make have already been made. So the first thing I'd like to say is we believe this bill makes a very important statement because it recognizes the value of caregivers who care full-time for their family members. And the MS Society believes that it should be the policy of the state of Oregon to support families who want to take care of sick family members themselves. You've already heard testimony about how important it is for families to stay together and to be in the home rather than in full-time care. I think one thing we really need to remember is that full-time caregivers are also often full-time parents with full-time jobs and full-time responsibilities in other areas. So it really is, or can be, a very stressful time when you've got family members taking care of spouses or children or brothers or sisters. And having that opportunity to take some respite care, whether it be a daycare type situation or actually a full week, that opportunity can make all the difference in the world between being able to continue providing the care for your family or to having to rely on a residential care facility. And that care, that respite care is good for the patient and for the family member. It gives that chance for the family member to run errands and do the things they need to do, but it also gives the patient time away from the family. It can be very stressful on a family relationship, whether it be a marriage or a relationship with a sibling or a child, to be fully dependent on somebody when you weren't dependent on them before, and I think that's an important thing to remember as well. And the second issue I'd like to talk about is the cost issue, and you've already heard how much it saves. It is a good investment, I think, to allow a $1,500 tax credit annually for families when the alternative can be as much as $3,000 a month. And I know that varies from $500 to $3,000 depending on the level of care. But either way, that $1,500 a year is a very sound investment for the state of Oregon. And I urge your support of the bill. Thank you.
Question.
I'm Nancy Talbot, and I live here in Salem. I'm a professional caregiver as well as have a sister who has multiple sclerosis, and I also have been involved on a volunteer basis with people with disabilities. So I have three different aspects of knowledge of caregiving, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Multiple Sclerosis Society this afternoon. I'm aware that multiple sclerosis is totally unpredictable. It's unpredictable in the age of the people that it affects. There are children that are affected with multiple sclerosis. I'm aware of new mothers who have a newly diagnosed condition, as well as people in their 70s that are just have a newly diagnosed. So it can affect the whole spectrum of ages of people and in many, many different ways. The caregiver of a person with MS cannot ever plan on anything because of that unpredictability. The plan made today might have to be canceled or postponed at the last moment because of an exacerbation, and you don't ever have any predictability about those exacerbations. You don't have any warning, so you might be all ready to go, and the person might just not be able to because they've experienced a setback. The $1,500 tax credit that House Bill 2495 would allow could provide a caregiver about 12 hours of respite care for at a $10 an hour fee, which is probably an average fee for a home caregiver, to come into the home. That time, of course, can be spent in time for the caregiver to rejuvenate themselves and be able then to continue to care for that person at home longer. It would be a way to lessen the burnout for the caregiver, and it also gives then that patient with MS a chance to stay at home longer because that their caregiver is able to care for them longer. I would urge you to pass House Bill 2495, and I appreciate being able to speak to you this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Gina Treese. Okay. That was the end of the testimony, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2495, the work session on House Bill 2495. Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, I move...
we have a dash one to do first.
I move that we accept the dash ones into 2495.
Representative Close has made the motion. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections to the dash one amendments? Hearing none, the dash ones are adopted. Representative Close, did you want to make the motion you were going to make earlier now?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2495 to the Revenue Committee with a due passage.
Representative Close moves House Bill 2495 as amended to the Committee on Revenue with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
House Bill 2495, having received the required majority, is declared passed and is now in the hands of the Revenue Committee, and I will vote this work session. Thank you all very much. Nice of you to do good things. I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 422.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 422 allows adult foster homes to accept one resident funded by Medicaid without being required to accept additional Medicaid residents. And this bill came from us to us from the Senate, where it received a 26-0 vote, one excuse, three on legislative business.
Okay, Grover Simmons.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again for the record, Grover Simmons representing adult foster homes. The situation which Senate Bill 422 addresses is that many foster home providers take only take only private pay residents in their home in some cases. And the reason for that is because the reimbursement rate from the Senior Disabled Services Division for Medicaid residents is so low that providers believe it is an inadequate pay for all the work that is involved. So when a caseworker comes to a home and asks these providers to accept one Medicaid resident, some providers say that they would be willing to accept one Medicaid resident, but by signing a Medicaid contract, they are obligated to accept additional Medicaid residents, and this could put them out of business in some cases. SB 422 simply says that a provider could accept one Medicaid resident without having to accept additional Medicaid residents. One important clarification is that where there is a person, a private pay person in the home already, and they spend down their assets so that they go on Medicaid, they are entitled to remain in the home. Period. Even under this bill, they would be entitled to remain in the home. So it has no adverse effect on the spend down situation. We believe that it represents good public policy because it will induce providers to take at least one Medicaid into their home as a new admission, where under present practices, some providers will not run the risk of being put out of business by having their home fill up with Medicaid residents for whom they think they would be inadequately paid. We think it would be good public policy, and we respectfully urge you to pass Senate Bill 422.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Simmons, is there any objection from any party to this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Piercy, not to my knowledge, in the Senate vote was there were no negative votes on the Senate side.
And in the hearing process as well?
This, no, there were no objections.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
According to the Senate sheet, there is at least one, May Dash.
Chairperson Cruz and members of the committee, again, my name is May Dash, and I'm representing the Oregon chapters of the Alzheimer's Association. We question the need for this bill, for its content already is covered by current law. We believe that the Ian Gross version of Senate Bill 422 actually may cause unnecessary confusion, for it seems to imply that an adult foster care provider licensed for Medicaid must accept at least one Medicaid client. It is our understanding that that simply is not true. A Medicaid licensed facility cannot be forced to accept even one Medicaid client. Those providers who are not very well versed in adult foster care law may misconstrue Senate Bill 422 to mean that if a home accepts a new Medicaid resident, that individual may displace a private pay resident already in the home when and if that individual runs out of money and goes on Medicaid. The current version of this bill could be seen by some as an opportunity to move a difficult resident out of a home. For example, a person with Alzheimer's disease who exhibits behavioral problems. If your committee plans to send this bill to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, our Coalition of Oregon Chapters urges you to eliminate the potential for confusion by adding a second provision under Section 2. We would suggest as follows to state, any resident in an adult foster care home who becomes eligible for Medicaid shall be allowed to remain in the home at the Medicaid rate. The Oregon chapters of the Alzheimer's Association do not support this bill. We believe that current law is adequate and that Senate Bill 422A and Gross actually has the potential for confusing that law. Thank you.
This is a very short bill. I guess I'm confused as to what could be confusing, where it simply states the Senior and Disabled Services Division may not require an adult foster home that elects to provide care for a Medicaid recipient to admit an additional Medicaid resident under contract within the division. I mean, I don't see where one could read that to say that they would have to take one. The language seems rather clear to me.
Chairperson Cruz, my feeling is that qualifier that SDSC may not require an adult foster care home that elects to provide care for a recipient to admit an additional one. In other words, if they already elect to provide care for one, then they don't have to admit an additional one. I do think it's confusing. And we do feel that the person who's in the facility already who runs out of private pay funds, since this is reiterating current law, we would suggest that this qualifier or this additional sentence be added to make it very clear that a private pay person who runs out of funds will not be will be allowed to remain.
Did you testify on this on the side?
What we did is we, as I recall, this was a very early hearing. We did not testify, but we did email to every senator our concerns about this bill before the vote. So they had it before, at the time of the House vote, I mean the Senate, the vote on the floor of the Senate.
Any questions? Ready? Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That was all the signed testimony, so I'm going to close the public hearing on 422, open a work session on Senate Bill 422.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Bill, the A and Grow Senate Bill 422 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Is there any discussion? Can you go get Representative Crummell, please? Representative Crummell, we are in work session on House Bill 420. Senate, excuse me. I have to learn to adjust here soon, I guess. Senate Bill 422, Representative Piercy has moved the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation. We are in the discussion phase. Do you have any discussion?
No.
Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Winter.
Aye.
Representative Piercy.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative
Hughes. Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye. Senate Bill 422, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Crummell, because you weren't here, would you like to carry it?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I'd be honored.
Okay. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 422, and I'm going to move to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Winters to vote on House Bill 2495. Hearing no objection.
How many votes do we need to suspend the rules?
We need, it has to be unanimous.
Oh. Of those present?
Yes.
Okay.
You're okay.
Hearing no objections, rules are suspended. I will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2495, work session, excuse me, and Kirk will call the very small roll.
Representative Winter.
Aye.
I will reclose the work session on House Bill 2495, and I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 425. Grover.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. For the record, Grover Simmons, representing adult foster homes. I do not have written testimony on this bill, which may be a blessing, but I'll just try to explain it very quickly. As you can tell, there is a statute pertaining particularly with respect to criminal background checks, pertaining particularly to adult foster homes. On the other hand, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, residential care facilities are all regulated under a different body of law. And we would like, adult foster homes would like to be included under the same body of law as everybody else. The one principal advantage of that is that a foster home has a requirement that if you haven't lived in Oregon for 5 years, you have to have a federal criminal background check as well as the state criminal background check. Whereas the body of law that we would like to be included under, like everybody else, has a 3-year window. So that's an advantage to us, and that is the most significant difference. So we were advised by Senior Disabled Services Division, the way to accomplish that would simply be to add the words shall be conducted in accordance with rules adopted under ORS 181.537. So that phraseology runs throughout the bill, and we're following their approach as to how to accomplish our goal of being treated like everybody else. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll ask Grover. Grover, this bill came out of the Senate committee unanimously, and then it became obviously a virtually a partisan issue on the Senate floor. Why was that?
I don't know that, Mr. Chair. I didn't hear the debate on this on the Senate floor, so I really just draw a blank on that.
Okay. I just find it interesting that some members that voted yes in committee voted no on the floor, and it turned from something that came out of committee unanimous turned into an 18-12 on the floor. Question is,
maybe somebody from SDSD could answer that, but I'm just not able to.
I know that sometimes things happen to bills that don't necessarily make a whole lot of sense if you look at the bill, which is Senator Piercy.
I have a question. Mr. Simmons, do you intend to request that the SDSD change the criminal records check rules that are now applicable to adult foster care facilities currently in effect?
Mr. Chair and Representative Piercy, yes. They, as you can see from the bill, the starting with line 18, for example, on the first page, 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22 would be deleted, 23 would be deleted, and that relates to adult foster home criminal record checks, and that's where that five-year point is included. And included, the amended would be on line 16, shall be conducted in accordance with rules adopted under ORS 181-537. So what this would accomplish would simply move the adult foster home industry from being treated separately and independently over into the group being treated the same as nursing homes, residential care facilities, and assisted living facilities. And that's what would be the result.
So you just want to change it, but you remain in favor of authorized provider designees to do records checks.
Where are you reading that?
I'm not reading that. I'm asking that. I'm just saying, are you do you continue to be in favor of criminal background checks?
Mr. Chair and Representative Piercy, yes, we do favor criminal background checks, and that has been our historic position from all along. We just really want to be treated equally.
And let's see. So what this would if I may, the current rules allow facilities except foster care facilities to have in-house people, that is, authorized provider designees, do record checks, right? So the current rules allow. And adult foster home facilities, I'm just trying to figure out, there's some issues here around concerns about who's going to do the checking and what, and you're just saying you wanted to move it so it's treated just like everyone else. SDSD right now has rule. What are their current rules right now? Can you tell me what that is?
Well, every provider, Mr. Chair and Representative Pearson, every provider who wishes to be an adult foster home caregiver has to have a state criminal background check.
Right.
And if they've not, in a foster home case, if they've not lived within Oregon, not lived in Oregon the last 5 years,
right,
they have to have a federal criminal background check. And the inconvenience of that is really an issue, because that takes months to get a federal criminal background check. But that's...
You want to eliminate the federal...
We're not touching that subject at all. All we're really saying is that we want to be treated the same as others. I don't even know why I mentioned that, how long it takes a federal one. And that's just the way... That's the practical inconvenience. But what we're attempting to do is to be treated identically as other providers, other caregivers, long-term caregivers.
Okay.
and SDSD would continue administering the system as they do now.
And look at statute of 4S18537. Basically, it gives the Department of Human Resources the responsibility and the authority to background checks and criminal checks, and then transfers that authority to those providers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you're saying is that you want to be under that same statute that everyone else is under.
Correct. Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winters, that's correct.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
David Brown.
Chairman Cruz and members of the board, I'm Dave Brandt. I'm an adult foster care provider in Joseph, Oregon, and I guess I don't have a whole lot to add to what Grover just said, other than there are several issues with adult foster care homes where we're not treated on an equal basis with rest homes and other care facilities, assisted living facilities, and I think this would be beneficial to us and a good faith gesture to treat us in the same manner with the same requirements as other people that are applicable in the same field as which we're in.
Any questions? Thank you. Committee will stand, please, for a moment. Well, I don't know. We're either going to move this or hold it over. Call the committee back to order, and I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 425 and open a work session on Senate Bill 425.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 425, A, engrossed Senate Bill 425, or if you pass recommendation.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Is there any discussion? There's no discussion. Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative
Winters?
Aye.
Representative
Piercy?
Aye.
Representative Beeman?
Aye.
Representative Snow?
Aye.
Jeffers? Aye. Okay, House Bill 420, Senate Bill 45, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Who would like to carry? Representative Winters? No. Okay.
No, Lehman.
Okay, Representative Lehman, it comes close to a lawyer type bill, so we'll let him do it. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 425. And so you don't want to vote on anything we already did?
Sure, that's what
I'll do. I would move to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Lehman to vote. And no objection, the rules are suspended. I will open a work session on House Bill 2495. Representative Lehman?
Aye.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2495. I will open a work session on Senate Bill 422. Representative Lehman?
Aye.
The work session on Senate Bill 422 and the committee.